Support for this KQED podcast comes from Walmart Labs, based in Silicon Valley. Powered by its own open source technology, Walmart Labs engineers code in an agile DevOps environment. Learn more about engineering and big data positions at walmartlabs.com.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum this morning, at least 50 migrants were found dead in the hold of a boat off the shores of Libya yesterday, and today 20 more were found dead in an abandoned truck in Austria, the latest asylum seekers to die attempting to cross into Europe. So far this year, more than 2,000 people have died attempting the sea crossing. But Europe remains divided on how to tackle the rising numbers of migrants. Slovakia refuses to accept Muslims, and Germany is seeing anti-immigration protests as it tries to absorb some of the 800,000 migrants expected to arrive this year. We discuss the crisis on Forum next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Just yesterday, some 50 migrants were found dead in the hold of a boat near Libya, and today at least 20 have been found dead in an abandoned truck in Austria. Many have died as hundreds of thousands have fled trying to reach Europe, a quarter of a million from Africa and the Middle East going across the sea this year fleeing war and poverty. In what is being characterized as the worst refugee crisis since the Second World War, Italy and Greece have been on the front lines for refugees washing ashore, but Germany and Sweden have processed 40% of European Union asylum seekers, seeking applicants. The humanitarian crisis grows, and it has ongoing major dramatic effects on both global and local politics, and we discuss the migrant crisis in this morning's opening Forum Hour. Joining us, I want to welcome Gregory Manatius, who is Senior European Policy Fellow with the Migration Policy Institute, also Senior Advisor to the United Nations on Immigration, and we welcome you to the program. Good morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Glad to have you. And Gregory Maniatis, excuse me, is with us from Middlebury, Vermont. We also have Cécile Alduy with us, Associate Professor of French Literature at Stanford. She's the author of a book called Marine Le Pen's Words, Deciphering the New National Front's Discourse, and has written a great deal on the shift to the right as a result of immigration and xenophobia. And we welcome you to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have Tom Nuttall, who is a Charlemagne columnist for The Economist, and he joins us from Brussels this morning. Tom Nuttall, welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
Good to have you. And Tom Nuttall, let me begin with you. This is what happened most recently in Austria. I know we don't know a lot about it, but that perhaps is symptomatic of what we're facing here with many of these really tragic events that occur.
Yeah, I mean, as you say, we don't know many of the details yet. But I think perhaps this points to two developments that tell us a little bit about the scale of the overall difficulty that Europe is facing. One thing is that as the number of people who are traversing this route, they generally begin in Greece, make their way up through the Balkans into Hungary, Austria. As that number grows and grows and grows, and the authorities do their best in certain places to make life difficult for some of these asylum seekers, then an increasing number of them will seek more covert means to make their journey. So in this case, we have a truck, but there's reports of lots of migrants using private vehicles rather than buses or trains to make their journey. The other thing is that, of course, this tells us that something which we already knew, which is that the people smugglers who have been operating in places like sub-Saharan Africa and Turkey are now operating within the borders of the European Union. So we don't know where these people were picked up. We don't know where they were on their way to. But there are now fairly well-established smuggling routes inside Europe itself.
This reminds me very much, of course, of what we have stateside here with the coyotes going over the border. It's very similar and parallel in many respects. But there is a summit over in Europe focusing on immigration that's going to take place in Vienna. What do we know about that, and what does it hope to accomplish?
Yeah, so this this summit, it began today. It's actually been planned for a long time. It's a summit on the Western Balkans, countries like Serbia and Albania. Originally, it had nothing to do with migration, but it's rather been hijacked by the events of the last few weeks. I think there has been some sort of announcement that there will be more monitoring of routes, a beefing up of presence of European officials at European external or European Union external borders. I'm not aware that anything dramatic is going to come out of an event like this, because the scale of this problem means it really needs European leaders to come together. And here we're talking people like Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany, François Hollande, the President of France, and people like that. So I think we can expect a lot more discussion over the next couple of months, and probably a lot more arguments, actually, between European countries as well.
Tom Natal, again, is Charlemagne columnist with The Economist. He's with us from Brussels. Gregory Maniatis is with us from Middlebury, Vermont. He's Senior European Policy Fellow with the Migration Policy Institute. Let's talk about scale with you, Gregory Maniatis. I mean, the numbers here, and particularly, can we really divide or discern what those numbers are? I know about a quarter of those who have been applying for asylum, for example, in Germany are really from the Balkans. I mean, they're just looking for a better life. How many are, in other words, motivated by economics, and how many are from, like the big numbers from Syria, from war-torn countries?
That's a really good place to start. One of the issues that has, I think, been really confused over the summer is how many of these are refugees, legitimate refugees, and how many are migrants who are economic migrants. And there is a distinction in law, and there's a distinction in politics as well. People are more willing, I think, to accept the idea that refugees need to be protected if they're fleeing from Syria or from Afghanistan or other countries at war. There is a responsibility for the international community to protect them. So if you look at what's happened thus far in Europe this summer and this year, you have roughly 43% of those who have crossed the Mediterranean are from Syria. Another 12% are from Afghanistan. Another 10% are from Eritrea. And 3% from Somalia. And then there's many others. But if you just add up those numbers, you're looking at roughly two-thirds at least of those who are crossing the Mediterranean have a legitimate claim to protection. They're not economic migrants. They're fleeing conflict.
This goes back, in fact, to 1951, doesn't it?
The Refugee Convention in 1951 defined a category of people for whom the international community is responsible. And I think that if you pull the lens back a little bit further, what you'll see is that the Syrian conflict is now in its fourth year. Other conflicts are much longer than that. And you have now on the borders of Europe in Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey, 4 million Syrians. Half of those are children. 750,000 of those children are not in school and haven't been for a year or two. And so the pressure is now building on their families to give them a life that is better. And the next step on their route out of Syria is Europe. And that's largely what you're seeing now. 80% of the Syrians arriving in Greece in recent days, 80% of those arriving in Greece are Syrian. So we have to focus on that issue. And in terms of the bigger picture, there were about 1.4 million immigrants to Europe last year. And so most of those came in legal ways with visas and by plane and train. What we now have is a much bigger percentage of that fairly large flow of migrants to Europe are now destitute migrants coming across chaotically. There were 70,000 who crossed the Mediterranean 2 years ago. We're on track for over 400,000 this year.
Now, I don't want to sound too harsh, but I think we can certainly use the word failure here. I mean, failure of European policymakers who should have had ways of dealing with those seeking asylum. But this is a global problem, and the responsibility, I think you've, for example, pointed out on a number of occasions, where are the Gulf countries in all this?
Absolutely. So there's two questions that you've raised. One is this a European-African problem? And it's not. The conflicts in Syria, the conflicts elsewhere are not the burden only of Europe or of Africa. So there is definitely a gap in the international system. There needs to be a better way to apportion responsibility for not only resolving conflicts, preventing conflicts, but once those conflicts take place, we need to have the world step up and help protect refugees. Most refugees in the world, 86% of them, are in the developing world. The developed world, countries in the West, the Gulf countries, they do not share much of the burden. They take a small part of it. But the other question that you raise is that the failure of European policymaking. It's absolutely clear that the European response this summer has been misguided. They started well in April when there was a case of 800 people dying in the Mediterranean. They reacted quickly and well by saying that our priority is to save lives. So they started saving lives in the Mediterranean, and they've done very well at that, despite the incidents of the past few days. But then the reaction has been not one that is collective, that says we need to, once we save them and they arrive in Greece and Italy, share the burden. They haven't gone there. They have simply gone into their own national holes and dug their own migration policies, and they haven't been able to collectively come up with a response. And one aspect of that response should be to give people a way to apply for asylum before they have to take the dangerous sea crossing across the Mediterranean.
Let me go back to Tom Nuttall for a moment, because that death rate from the Mediterranean has actually plummeted, at least for where Italy is concerned, in recent months. And what we just heard about, well, there was a great deal of expanded resources that were put in after the tragedy back in April. But do you think that since then there's been a failure of policy?
Yeah, I mean, the difficulty is that on the one hand, you have a problem that looked like it's almost tailor-made for the European Union. It very evidently demands countries to work together, to harmonize policies, to share burdens. On the other hand, you're talking here about an issue, asylum, migration, who gets to reside within a country's border. That is pretty much as close to the heart of national sovereignty as it gets. And when you combine these two issues, then you end up with a situation like the one that we're in today. Now, the problem is a lot of asylum seekers, most asylum seekers who arrive in Europe, they have strong preferences over one, reaching one part of the continent than another. So lots of them, as you were saying earlier, want to head for Germany. Lots of them want to head for Sweden. They have different reasons for doing this. For some, it may be because they're joining family or joining an established diaspora. For others, it may be because there's a particular labor market that they want to reach. For others, it may simply be that they've heard that this is a good place to be. But when you have governments jealously protecting their sovereignty in the area of asylum, in the area of migration, then you're inevitably going to end up with difficulties like this. You're going to end up with the pinch points that we've seen emerging all over Europe, from Greece to Macedonia to Hungary to the port of Calais for people who want to reach the United Kingdom. And at the moment, we haven't yet seen European countries work together in a way that's necessary to resolve these sorts of difficulties. So one thing that they have managed to do, and it's a minor achievement, but it is something, is they've agreed on a scheme to take a small number of asylum seekers who are arriving in Italy and Greece from certain countries and to redistribute them around most of the other countries of the European Union. Now, the number that they've agreed on is minuscule. It's 32,000 and something. Now, this is less than the number of asylum seekers who arrived in Greece last month alone. So it's not going to make a huge dent in the problem. But measured against the European Union's own standards, this is actually something of an achievement, because it marks a break with the principle that asylum seekers are the sole responsibility of the country in Europe to which they happen to reach first. And the hope of the bureaucrats in Brussels, of the European Commission, is that this scheme, they call it the relocation plan, is going to be the first step towards something much, much more comprehensive. But it's turned out to be extremely politically divisive, and I think you're going to see a lot more discussion about this.
Divisive, particularly because of sovereignty, and because each country is going through what can only be described as catastrophic effects. I mean, you mentioned last month in Greece, 50,000, most Syrians and Iraqis, tried to essentially get into Greece. And so the number does seem minuscule, but 800,000 are expected trying to get into Germany. These are not sustainable numbers.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, the German issue is key to this, because when the proposal to relocate asylum seekers was first floated back in May, this was an idea that the European Commission, which is the executive part of the European Union, proposed. It was squashed largely in the face of opposition from Eastern European countries, who are very hostile to this idea. Now, this idea, the Commission is going to float this plan again probably by the end of the year. But what seems to have changed in the intervening period is what's happened in Germany. Now, Germany, as you say, is expecting 800,000 asylum seekers this year. This is way, way beyond anything that they've ever had to deal with before. And you're now starting to see the German government become a lot more assertive in its diplomacy on this. So earlier this week, Angela Merkel, the Chancellor, got together with François Hollande, the President of France, to call for a number of things. Now, one of those is what's called a safe country list. And the reason to put together something like this would be a list of countries that are presumed to be safe. So if you are an asylum seeker from one of these countries and you make a claim, your claim will still be assessed, but it will be expedited. And Germany is very keen to do this because, as Gregory was saying before, a large number of the asylum seekers that are reaching Germany are from Balkan countries like Serbia, like Albania, that may be economically troubled, but are at peace. And Germany is groaning under the weight of these arrivals. So it wants to have this safe country list to which it can return other people. But Germany is going to be pushing a lot harder on other parts of the migration agenda as well, including, I would imagine, a much more ambitious approach to relocate asylum seekers around other European Union countries, as well as to have a much more ambitious resettlement plan. That means taking in refugees, people who already have refugee status, who are in countries like Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon, and distributing them around the EU, the idea being that you provide a safe route into Europe for some of these people so that they don't have to make the dangerous illicit attempts to enter the European Union.
Let me also add that Chancellor Merkel is trying to work with the EU on a plan, but Germany has four times last year's total, and this has caused protests against migrants coming into Germany or against trying to absorb them in the numbers they've been absorbed. And this leads me to you, Cécile Alduy. Cécile Alduy, again, is the author of Marine Le Pen's Words, Deciphering the New National Front's Discourse. There's been a great deal of more nationalism, xenophobia, and frankly, right-wing activity as a result of all this, as there has been, one could argue, in the United States.
Yes, and I don't know if it's the result or if you know, the political climate in Europe was already rife for this kind of xenophobic, nationalistic rhetoric that we've seen in the last few years. But what has been really damaging in the current situation for the way policymakers are able to actually implement decisions is that there have been a confusion in the media and by politicians between regular immigration to Europe, mostly economic immigration, which is resented by a huge number of Europeans at the present moment because of the economic crisis in most countries, and the question of refugees and asylum seekers. And it's only recently that a debate has started to really happen among European countries about the differences and the diversity of those migrants that are coming across the Mediterranean Sea at their own peril. So I think that there are two sides of the equation here. There is the ability of the European Union as an institution to really live up to its legacy as a place to welcome and protect other people who are in danger for their own lives. And on the other side, there is the realm of politics. And it's much more confusing, polarized, and also not that responsible field, where people are really battling for their own positions. We are in an electoral period in France right now, and it's not going to stop until the presidential elections in 2017. And so there's a lot of posturing, gesturing towards the fringe ranks of the electorate, and also fear-mongering. And this doesn't help public opinion to really assess and understand that we are in a refugee crisis rather than an immigration crisis.
It's also, as you outline it, I think, a humanitarian crisis, but also a political one. I mean, the landscape is full of all kinds of political rhetoric and minefields now. And what are we to make of the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, Slovakia, for example, said we're not taking any Muslim refugees at all?
Yes, so it's everything is kind of colliding into one big mess right now in the collective imagination. As you remember, this year or so, the terrorist attack in France, the rhetoric against the Muslim population all over Europe has escalated. And there is this conflation of images of migrants coming on European shores and the collective fears of a so-called invasion of Europe by other populations. And this is where I think it's very interesting to see why people have to be extremely careful about the words they use, and the media, politicians, intellectuals should also really point out when rhetoric is beyond politics and creates a climate that is going to be welcoming the worst feelings among the population as regards to others who might have a very legitimate right to come and seek asylum.
And again, Cécile Alduy is associate professor of French literature at Stanford. Gregory Maniatis is senior European policy fellow with the Migration Policy Institute. As we come up here on a break, Gregory Maniatis, what can the international community do? What should they do?
First of all, there should be a collective effort to support those states that are hosting the largest number of asylum seekers and refugees. And in this context, those states are Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. There's 4 million. If conditions there are bad, if the kids who are there, half of the 4 million are children, cannot go to school, they will push on to Europe. So we need to have a response and in terms of support to these countries that is of a scale that matches up with the challenge. That is the number one, I think, priority that we have.
Well, what about, I'm getting a lot of emails here about how can the average person help. Looking at an email from a listener named Richard who says, I remember post-World War II, people could sponsor families displaced by the war.
Absolutely. So Tom mentioned earlier that there's a resettlement program. It's really the only organized way for refugees to go from frontline states to more peaceful, developed places. So resettlement accommodates about 100,000 refugees every year, but there are 20 million refugees in the world, and that has been growing at a pace of around 2 million a year. So that resettlement program, by which people go in an orderly way from frontline states to other countries, could grow a lot. There is a form of resettlement which is called private sponsorship, where individuals and churches and NGOs can sponsor individuals to come to their countries, to their communities. The Canadians have done this on a very big scale. Canada is a relatively small country in terms of population. I think their numbers for private sponsorship of refugees is about 30,000. So if the world, if Europe, if the U.S. and Australia, the Gulf countries, could increase the number of people that they take through orderly fashion, that will lower the numbers that need to go through in a disorderly way across the Mediterranean.
Well, getting a lot of comments along the lines of who ought to take responsibility. In fact, John writes, why not look at root cause? Countries who cause or contribute to conflict should take the refugees. U.S., Iran, Israel should therefore take the majority. You can weigh in with your opinion, and we would like to hear from you if you have some thoughts about the migrant crisis, hundreds of thousands fleeing to Europe. If you'd like to weigh in here or join the conversation with any questions or comments, you can do so now. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, the number to call, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the migrant crisis, and we have recent news that we've brought to the fore here about 50 migrants being found dead in the hold of a boat off the shores of Libya yesterday, and others found dead in Austria in a truck earlier today. So far this year, more than 2,000 people have actually died in attempting the crossing, and Europe remains very divided. Real question is, what can be done? What ought to be done? Looking not necessarily for answers here, but at least for ways of trying to provide for what I would call, not hesitantly, a tsunami. We've got Gregory Maniatis with us, who is Senior European Policy Fellow with the Migration Policy Institute and Senior Advisor to the United Nations on Immigration, and also Tom Natal, who is Charlemagne columnist with The Economist. That's not all, excuse me. And Cécile Alduy, Associate Professor of French Literature at Stanford and author of Marine Le Pen's Words, Deciphering the New National Front's Discourse. We do invite your involvement in the program, and you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, or by calling us at our toll-free number, which is 866-733-6786. I want to get a caller on here named Molly, who I think has some important information to share with us. Molly, welcome.
Hi, this is Molly from Gilroy, and I just wondered, your guest mentioned that individual families can become hosts for refugees. Could you give us a website or a phone number to find that information out?
Yeah, Gregory Menaches.
So there is only a very small program like this in the United States. I know that the government is trying to expand it, and you can find that on the State Department website, and we can post it, I imagine, to the KQED website as well.
Well, let's do that, and let me thank Molly for the call and go right to another caller. That's Joan. Joan, join us.
Yes. What percentage of the refugees has the United States taken, and how many have we taken, and how does this compare to, say, Turkey or Jordan or Italy? The other thing is, if we were maybe the one of the prime causes of the problems that we're having now, wouldn't we have a moral responsibility?
Well, that's what another listener suggested. It's hard to pin down who's responsible for some of these global problems, or certainly problems in the Middle East. But Gregory Miniatis, you want to opine on, or at least give us the figures, excuse me, of how many American?
Sure. It's a really good question. So the U.S. takes, in a very organized fashion, about 70,000 refugees a year from refugee camps or from frontline states through this resettlement program. So you compare that to Germany and the 800,000 expected asylum applications this year, it seems relatively small. And it is relatively small. The U.S. is far from most of these conflicts. But you remember last summer, there was a different kind of refugee flow to the United States across the Mexican border of primarily young children fleeing gang violence in Central America. That's a different kind of situation. Formally, many of those are not refugees because the 1951 convention that you mentioned, Michael, does not apply to necessarily those fleeing gang violence. So the U.S. has orderly flows through resettlement, and then it had a disorderly situation last summer. You asked another question, which I think is an important one, and that is, who caused the problem? And Michael, you ended the last segment by pointing out that those countries that caused the problem could potentially be responsible. It's an important issue to debate. It's hard to say that the current conflict in Syria, who is responsible for intervening or not intervening. You can go back and say that it was the Iraq invasion that led to the creation of ISIS or turmoil. It's hard to point that out. There have been some interesting ideas put out into the debate recently, one by a professor at Oxford named Guy Goodwin-Gill, who is advocating the idea that countries from where refugees come, like Syria, should be held legally and financially responsible for the care of those refugees so that the international community could, for instance, seize their assets abroad and use those funds in order to support refugees that have come from those countries. It's a complicated idea, but it's an interesting one, and it shows how much at a loss we really are for dealing with the scale of the problem that we now face.
Let me, in fact, go to an email here, Gregory, from a listener named Kyle, who says, does Europe have the wherewithal, this has to do with scale, and resources to support this influx of refugees? How many refugees might go to Europe in the next 5 or 10 years?
So that is the heart of the question. I think there is a specter of fear that there will be millions. Hungary's prime minister has spoken of hundreds of millions of refugees coming to Europe. I think that's a wild exaggeration. But the point is that there are things that the European Union can do within its means quite easily right now to calm the situation and make it less of a crisis. It did that in April and May when it said it was going to rescue people at sea. For 2 years, it refused to do that, and it suddenly did, and it did it really well. Now the question is, can it take on the tens of thousands arriving every month in Greece and Italy and give them shelter and register them and give them decent housing? Of course it can. When there are earthquakes, and when there were earthquakes in Greece or Turkey earlier in the 2000s, they were able to respond very quickly. If you want to, the money is there and the means are there. The harder question is, what happens when you reach 1 million, 2 million, 3 million? What is the carrying capacity of the European Union to be able to provide protection to others? That's a good question. Back in the 1956, when the Soviet Union invaded Hungary, the Europe back then, much poorer, was able to relocate 200,000 Hungarians to other parts of Europe and to the rest of the world, as far away as Brazil and Iceland, within a matter of weeks. It was able to do it then. We can do it now. We have to make the decision to do it.
Let me go back, if I may, to Tom Nadal, who is, again, Charlemagne columnist with The Economist and is with us from Brussels. Tom, Jan writes, one of our listeners, the only real cure for the refugee crisis is to stop the war in Syria. If the EU, if the EU concentrate its efforts on solving that war, and what are they doing to exert pressure, she wants to know, on Russia and Iran in that regard?
Well, I mean, every time this issue rises to the top of the agenda, we hear about the need to tackle root causes. Now, what are root causes? You could say that root causes are civil strife in Syria. You could say that it's the police state in Eritrea. You could say it's the smuggling networks operating in Africa and elsewhere that enable people to make these journeys. You could say it's the chaos, the political vacuum in Libya. And then you can start talking about poverty, and you can even start talking about climate change. So one of the concerns I have is that although obviously the EU and all other significant world powers need to be doing everything that they can to ensure stability in Libya and end to fighting in Syria and so forth, a lot of the time when you hear politicians talk about root causes, actually what they're saying is, let's do nothing at all. Because if it was easy to have an established government in Libya, if it was easy to bring an end to fighting in Syria, then we would have done it already. And it hasn't escaped my notice that in a lot of the arguments that have taken place in Europe over the last few months about how to share the burden for asylum seekers, those skeptical countries, particularly in Central and Eastern Europe, they are the ones who are making these arguments loudest of all. What we need to do is tackle the root causes. And when I hear that, what I'm hearing is, let's do nothing at all. So while it does, if you are going to have a comprehensive migration agenda, and you do need to have one because this is an immensely complicated subject, while dealing with some of the causes of these flows is crucial to that, and for what it's worth, the EU is involved in the UN-led attempt to have a reconciliation of the sparring governments in Libya, and is doing other things. That can only ever be part of this discussion, and let's face facts. We're not going to have an established government in Libya anytime soon. We're not going to see an end to the fighting in Syria anytime soon. So whatever it is that we're doing in these places to help tackle the root causes, we are going to be dealing with these flows of asylum seekers, of migrants into Europe, and that is the problem that right now demands tackling, and so we have to think about solutions to that.
And we will go to more of your calls in just a moment. I want to go to an online comment and bring Cecile Audouy back into this. Cecile, a listener named Ben, writes the following. The response of Europe is not surprising, since many of these migrants come from Muslim countries and there is a connection between Islam and terrorism, real or not. When we read about Muslim gun-toting radicals attempting to shoot up trains, the average European is probably a little freaked out about this mass migration. That average European then puts pressure on their politicians.
Unfortunately, this is entirely true. Public opinion is not at all prepared for this influx of population from mostly Muslim countries. And this is where it really looks like a long-prepared disaster, because it's not only a humanitarian and political emergency. It's also a crisis that happens in a political context that is anything but prepared to deal with it in a positive, constructive way. So the question of Islam in Europe is a very heated one. And, of course, this is where the irrational, the imagination, takes over the need for purposeful responses. When you see those images of migrants coming across, the big problem is that for public opinion across Europe, it evokes the same images that have been fed to them by the far right and by others about this invasion of Europe from the Middle East. And so there's this conflation between images that are now real of people coming because they have no other choices, and
a long narrative that we've been hearing of this invasion that is supposed to be happening of Europe by Muslim populations. This is almost as difficult an issue to deal with as the concrete, pragmatic resolution of the facts on the grounds, because changing or turning around public opinion and the collective imagination takes even more years than making policy decisions.
Let me bring more of our callers on. Henry, thank you for waiting. Join us. You're on the air.
Hi, Michael. This is a very interesting discussion. But honestly, I have to say, it seems like we're having this is a canary in the coal mine type of a situation. I mean, we're entering into a new Darwinian era. And, you know, Paul Ehrlich at Stanford predicted this years ago. And the real fundamental core problem is population. And if you think about what's going to happen with all the displaced people, with global warming, that's all projected. I mean, we are talking millions and millions and millions of displaced people. So to talk about, you know, dealing with 700,000 or 800,000 war-induced refugees is really the wrong problem to talk about. And the thing that strikes me with some these days is that the talk about population management just non-existent. So it's interesting to have this discussion, but it's the wrong discussion.
All right. Henry, I thank you for those comments. We'll let them stand. I want to go to more of your online comments. A listener writes, a European challenge is not just the vast number of immigrants, but the number of disenchanted immigrants and their offspring who find themselves still living in poverty in a declining Europe and then resort to terrorism. Countries have a right to borders. It's a matter of finding a reasonable balance. And we haven't found that yet. Rick writes in an email, I think that it's unfair to demean the average citizen's concern for the quality of life and tax consequences of unlimited refugee arrival. If you open the borders, most first world countries would be overwhelmed by this massive influx, and he puts parenthetically invasion, of third world migrants. These groups would drastically change the quality of life in the receiving countries. The capacity does not exist. I'm struck, though, Gregory Miniatis, again, by analogies to the situation here. You were talking before about those fleeing from Central American countries because of violence, but you have the same, what Cecile was talking about, with concern about xenophobia, nationalism as a result to those coming across our borders, and you have also the fact that there's great human capital in this, but there's also really concern that citizens do have about sustainability and what it does to the economy.
Absolutely. These are very legitimate concerns. But I think both in the United States, but especially in Europe, the question that we have to answer first is, can we do better? And we can do better. We don't have to imagine and be paralyzed by the idea that there will be 50 million people coming across. We have had a few hundred thousand this summer, which logistically, financially, we're able to handle. We haven't handled it. We haven't done the things that would calm the situation and then also make it easier to deal with the Marine Le Pens and the concerns, the legitimate concerns that people have about integration.
We've also got, excuse me, though, to deal with what I can only characterize as criminality in all this. I mean, the smugglers and those who are dealing in the whole black market of taking people aboard ships and in some instances almost certifying the likelihood of they're not making it across. This is a staggering problem and can't be separated from the old problem.
It can't be, but let's go back to May when the European Union decided that the solution to the Mediterranean crisis was to have a military intervention, and it spent the month of May and most of June trying to convince the Security Council of the United Nations to authorize this operation. That authorization never happened, but the military mission is underway. Within weeks, those tides of people shifted to other parts of the Mediterranean. And I think what that points to is the need, first of all, to go after the smugglers, but second, to have really good relationships with those countries on the front lines like Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan in order to be able to work together with them to go after these networks. If we want those kinds of good relationships, we need to help them with their 4 million refugees on their territory. And if we do that, I think we will have a common cause to go after the smugglers in a more effective way than we have been able to thus far.
Cécile Alduy, you have a socialist government in France, and at present, and certainly France has always identified itself as being a liberal place in favor of, multicultural movement forward and all of that sort of thing. But what are we seeing now in terms of Le Pen and on the right and all that? Is that gaining steam?
Yeah, well, the multicultural tendencies are really losing steam in France. I would say that the name socialist government is not exactly descriptive of what the government has been doing in the last 3 years.
I'll rephrase that. Technically socialist.
Technically speaking, socialist government. The problem is there are two problems. One is that in the last 10 years, we've been a shift to the right of the political debate in France, which means that the conservative right has started to adopt and reuse the same inflammatory rhetoric against immigration as the far right. So now the political center of the debate has shifted so far on the right that on the left, there's just no discussion of immigration at all. There's this fear that this is such a hot topic that they will burn their fingers even trying to touch on it. So there's a vacuum on the left for proposing an alternative discourse that would, for instance, frame a picture of dealing with the current humanitarian crisis that does not raise fears about increased economic burden, for instance. One thing I would like to comment about the previous caller's comment is that the refugees that are coming right now do not come for economic reasons, and some of them are engineers, lawyers, doctors. Europe is a declining demographic in terms of the future prospect of its population. Germany's industries have been welcoming this influx of refugees because they know that there's going to be a shortage of manpower, including qualified jobs that these people could probably fulfill. So there's, again, a question of preparing public opinion and making sure that the right information is communicated about the diversity of profiles of these refugees who come with nothing on their shoulders right now because of the dire situation that they're in, but who might have had a life of being a lawyer or an engineer 10 years ago.
Well, we're covering certainly a broad swath here and talking about different situations in different nations throughout Europe. But maybe, Tom Nuttall, can you maybe update us on Calais?
Yeah, I mean, the Calais situation is a very telling one, I think, because in terms of numbers, it's absolutely minuscule. I was there a few weeks ago, and you've got maybe 3,000 people who are camped out in Calais. For your listeners who aren't aware, Calais is a French port that is pretty much the closest part of France to the United Kingdom. And so what you have here is a whole bunch of people who have been camped out, and this problem goes back years, more than a decade, but it's been exacerbated in the last few months. You've got people from both the Middle East and from Africa who want, for one reason or another, to get to the United Kingdom. Now, there are many reasons why they might want to go there. Britain has a much lower unemployment rate than most of Europe. It's easier to get a job. There are no identity cards, unlike most of Europe, so it's easier to get into the shadow economy. There are lots of diasporas there, so you may be able to join an established network. But despite the fact that the numbers here are so small, it's caused an absolute political earthquake in Britain. Now, one reason for this is that Britain has been going through a period of what we might call the wobblies over immigration lately. But I think another, perhaps more important reason is that what we've seen are television images of mainly young men who are jumping over fences, clambering onto the tops of trucks, trying to hide themselves inside trains so that one way or another they can sneak themselves into Britain. And even though the numbers are small, what these images do, what they suggest to people in Britain, is that the government is not in control of its own borders. And that's one of the most devastating charges that you can lay against a government, that it is not controlling its own borders, particularly in an island nation like like the United Kingdom, which is not part of what's called the Schengen area, which is which covers most of Europe. It's a passport-free zone, so you can travel from one country to another without showing your passport. Britain is not in that. So what we have here is a small number of people who are able to cause absolute chaos. And this shows that this is a very good example of how a limited number of people, because of the fragmented nature of asylum and migration policy in Europe, are able to cause a political earthquake, and they haven't quite worked out how to deal with it yet.
I'm looking at some emails here that I want to bring into the mix. This is from Catherine, who writes, I am living in a small provincial town in northeast Germany with a population of 40,000. This year alone, the town has welcomed more than 750 refugee families. Today, 150 refugees are being housed in the high school. The anti-refugee marches, etc., are not happening everywhere. Tomorrow, I will attend a welcome dinner, an evening of music for and by the refugees. The Yazidis, Kurds, and Syrian Christians will be selling food and collecting money to sent to refugee camps in Turkey. Please let your listeners know that many Germans are welcoming and helping these people. On the other hand, we have Joan, who emails this. Just got back from a trip to the Baltics in Lithuania. A mainstream journalist, a former government official, said that Lithuania has been asked to take 250 migrants, which he called a calamity for Lithuania. This after he complained that they're losing population as Lithuanians leave for other EU countries. Wouldn't working-age migrants help them address that problem? His answer, they're not Christians. Let me bring in some more of your calls. Let me go next to Philip. Good morning.
Hi, my name is Dilip from San Jose.
Sorry, Philip.
Dilip, D-I-L-I-P. Well, my question was about ISIS and the role ISIS played in this. You know, Middle East always had the problem, but ISIS made it much, much worse. And, you know, Bush and Cheney lied through their teeth to take us to the war, and they couldn't have done a worse job in managing the war after taking us to the war. But anyway, ISIS being a result of the Iraq war, most experts agree. So what percent of the numbers, in terms of numbers, are direct results from the ISIS crisis?
I mean, can we get a fix on that, Gregory Menendez?
I think it's very hard to say that ISIS is at the heart of this. I mean, the Syria crisis has been going on for quite a while. The Middle East crisis and for much longer than that. Certainly ISIS is a factor. They're driving people out of parts of Syria and parts of Iraq. So certainly a percentage of the refugees reaching Europe are getting there or being forced to flee as a result of ISIS. But I think it's a relatively small percentage if you could ever try to ascribe responsibility like that.
Well, here's a solution I've not heard before. Robert writes, the West has not had such a refugee problem since World War II. After the war, through the United Nations, in order to settle Jewish refugees, it took land and created a new state for them, Israel. This could be done again. Take a chunk of Libya, a state without a real government, make a new country for the refugees. Sounds outlandish, except it was done before.
This is something that has gained currency. Refugia is the name of one of those ideas. Let's create a nation called Refugia. But doing that would be extremely expensive. It would send perhaps the wrong signal to people all over the world that we need to isolate refugees. And it would be far harder and far more expensive than supporting frontline states and expanding legal channels like resettlement and like private sponsorship. Why go there when you have solutions at hand?
I'm reading another email here from a listener named Ben who writes, if you think the number of asylum seekers is large now, you have not seen anything yet, as the number of people who will be attempting to migrate when their low-lying countries are flooded by global climate change, ocean rise, and weather changes will greatly exceed the current numbers. India, for example, has built a wall between Bangladesh and itself, but very few media report on it. Is that true, Gregory?
Well, I think it's hard to anticipate what will happen to the climate and what once the climate changes, people will do in response to it.
No, I'm just asking if there's a wall between Bangladesh and India. If there is, I mean, Trump's talking about building a wall here, but I hadn't heard that.
No, I mean, I think that that's somewhat of an exaggeration.
Well, there is a Tom Nuttall, there is a fence in Hungary, right?
The Hungarians are building a fence along their wall, along their border with Serbia, which has been one of the main crossing points for migrants heading up from Greece who want to enter Central Europe, Austria and Germany. And one of the ironies of this is that it appears that one reason that we've had this recent surge of migrants, particularly Syrians from Turkey into Greece, is that they want to make sure that they're able to make that crossing before that fence is completed. So actually, it appears to have had the opposite, at least in the short term, it appears to have had the opposite effect from what it was intended to do. I just wanted very briefly to go back to a comment that that you read out from someone who I think had just been in Lithuania, who was speaking about the climate there. It's fascinating if you watch the debate that's happening in these countries. They are accepting a very, very small number of people under the EU's plan, less than 1,000 between the three of them, the three Baltic states. And yet, they're having an extremely impassioned debate about what this is going to do to national character. Now, in these three countries, they have begun to have debates over whether they should ban the burqa or not, the Islamic face covering veil. These are countries that are going to be accepting, as I say, less than 1,000 people. I think this tells you something about some of the debates that are beginning to take place, particularly in countries in the eastern half of the continent that have no real recent history of immigration to speak of. There are a lot of people who are very worried about accepting even a small number of people from unfamiliar cultures.
Yeah, those debates have been longstanding in France, so it's interesting to see them now cropping up in other countries. It's an ongoing problem. We will continue to follow it. I want to thank all our guests, Tom Nuttall, again, a Charlemagne columnist for The Economist. Cécile Aldoui is Associate Professor of French Literature at Stanford. Her book is Marine Le Pen's Words. And Gregory Maniatis is Senior European Policy Fellow with the Migration Policy Institute. I thank you one and all. Thank you, our listeners. Forum is produced by Irene Gucci, Tina Larberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are LaToya Tools and Jeremy Siegel. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.